Well, if you'd pull out your outlines that say, wake up, I would like to dive right in and start to talk about the Church of Sardis, Revelation chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. I'm grateful that we have fewer verses to go through this week than last week. This is great. I feel really excited about these six verses. I've also provided you with some pictures that are on the center of your worship guide, which give you a pictorial view of not only where Sardis was, but some of the things that are left over, really, from Sardis, some of the historical excavations that have gone on in Sardis and what those have revealed to us. You might have noticed, by the way, that we are printing the center piece of our worship guide and the inside of our worship guide in black and white. And I'd like to tell you why. If you'll pull out your worship guides real quick, this one, the one that says wake up on it, if you'd pull it out and take a look at the giving, the LBAC giving report, it's right down there at the bottom. In fact, some of you might have missed it. It's that small in our worship guide. We don't want to make a big deal out of the bucks, right? We're serving God. Worship, you know, part of our worship is giving. We are not a church that focuses on this or gets weird about it. But we want to make sure that everybody knows what's going on financially around this place. And so if you look down at the second to last line, year to date, we are required $404,832.96. All right? I mean, that's very specific, isn't it? And then look to the right of that. We have received $404,310.91. Do you notice that that number is lower than the one on the left? What is required is lower than what has been received. That was a line for us. Earlier in the year, we were below this line, and we shot up to 119% of that particular line in our budget, and we have slowly dropped now back down to 100% statistically. But if you would look at, you can see it's below that line. And when that happens, we begin to enact certain things at the church that will help us save money. And by printing our worship guides on the inside in black and white, we save. It's about $70 a week. But what that amounts to until the end of the year was close to $1,000. Now, for some of you, you don't care. You've been at this church forever, and you're like, I don't care if you print it in black and white, blue and white. I could give a rip. All that color was distracting to me anyway. It's like reading USA Today. I want my newspaper in black and white. That's traditionally how it's been, and that's how I want it. But I just want to point out that we print our worship guides and our outlines, and we do all of this kind of thing, particularly for those that are going to be coming into our church. Because we want to make sure that what we are presenting is a view, not only of Long Beach Alliance Church, but of the Lord, that is the very best that we can do. And right now, what you're experiencing is the best that we can do, but I believe that we can do better. And because of that, I just want to point out that the reason that we're doing it this way is because we crossed over a line that we need to make adjustments for on our team. And so if you were wondering, why are they printing it in black and white now? That is so hard to tell what these pictures are. It just looks like a big gray blob of stuff. That's why. I just wanted to point that out to you. We're also using different paper, the whole 10 yards. We priced it all out and figured it all out, and this is where we have landed. And so I wanted to explain that to you, and I want to encourage you as we head towards these last few months in our church budget, the last few months of this year, as we head, that's not like a reference to the Mayan thing that we're all going to die on the, you know, end of December. As we head towards the end of our year, which for us is also our fiscal year, could I just encourage you to be faithful, to be generous, and to give to the Lord, not to this church. I mean, we're a part of what God is doing, and so this is the route that God has called us into giving, is to His local church family. But could I just please call you to being faithful to the Lord and joyful in the way that you respond to Him because it really does make a difference. It makes a difference in how we reach out. It makes a difference in what we do internally. It makes a difference in our church. And that's why your worship guide looks a little bit different. So with all that in mind, I want to talk about a church that was very wealthy. Oh, isn't that great? The church in Sardis was an extremely affluent city. Or the city of Sardis was a very affluent city because of its location. If you look on the map, the roads kind of meet in the city of Sardis, and it's because they were at the end of a lucrative trade route. You can note those roads, and there was an abundant presence of silver and gold. You can see some of the local coinage. And by the way, those are gold. Those pictures just are representative. They had so much local coinage that was actually minted right there next to Sardis. Sardis fell, though, to military conquest when the unscalable walls of Sardis, whenever a city was going to be attacked, they usually went to an acropolis. Have you heard that word before? There's a Greek acropolis that some of you might be familiar with. Acropolis literally means, acro means edge or the extremity, and polis means city. So it was something that was on the edge of the city that the whole city would get inside of, and they would close the gates. And in Sardis, there were three natural steep cliffs that protected the Acropolis on three sides. And they were considered just impossible to penetrate. So Sardis only had to defend one side of the city, and so it was considered impossible. It would take forever to break through into Sardis until, while the guards were not watching those steep cliffs, military guys that were attacking the city climbed up those cliffs in the clefts where no one could see them, and they got into the city, opened the front gates, and ravaged the city of Sardis. And so in the ancient world, in the Greek world, capturing Sardis was considered doing the impossible. It was pigs that fly. You know what I mean? It was the impossible dream kind of thing. To capture Sardis was an idiom, a phrase that was used for achieving the impossible. I want my kids to clean their room. I might as well try to capture Sardis. That kind of thing, okay? It was just dreaming of what would not be. Sardis was also the home of an incredible temple complex built to cult worship, primarily of Artemis. The region experienced a catastrophic earthquake in 17 AD. That was actually during the time of Christ, when Plinius, or Pliny, a famous Roman author, called that disaster the greatest one in human history. It devastated the area of Sardis and blew this temple literally to the ground. The entire roof of the complex was knocked down, and several of the pillars that it was built on were knocked down. It was rebuilt, and it was still quite majestic, and there are still some of those Ionic pillars are still there to this very day. That's how extraordinary this structure was. And you can see those there. I think each Ionic pillar is something like 58, almost 60 feet tall. I mean, it was really spectacular. It was an incredible complex. And so the city was very dedicated to cult worship of Artemis. The wealth, though, of Sardis is really its greatest mark. The wealth of this city was pretty significant. And it extended deeply into the local church and, even before the local church, the Jewish synagogue. And you can see a picture. The Jewish synagogue was actually connected, like physically connected, to the Greek gymnasium in town. Now, that may not seem like much to you. Oh, that's kind of cool. You mean it was one of those modern churches that had like maybe a little food court? And it had a gym that was attached to it. That makes perfect sense to me. I want to go to a church like that. Did you get a free membership? What would that be like? And that kind of thing. It not quite like that. The Greek gymnasium was a center for Greek culture, and it was a center for training up of mostly the rich young youth that were in that city or in that town. And there were traditions that went on at the gymnasium. They came from the very first gymnasiums, And one of them was that everyone who worked out, most of the people that worked out were very young, very fit, looked very good. All right, but they would oil their bodies down in order to work out. Because in Greek culture, the male body was considered the height of beauty. And so they would oil down their bodies, oftentimes shaving their bodies, and then oiling them down in order to work out. Now, I don't know if you've been to the gym locally. I know some of you avoid the gym and that kind of thing, probably for good reasons. But one of the funniest parts of going to the gym, I roll into the gym looking like a truck hit me, right? I haven't shaved. I haven't done any. I look terrible. And then I work out, and I usually shower at the end of that and you know, shave and get all cleaned up and that kind of thing before I leave. Nothing is funnier to me than these women that come to the gym looking like they are modeling. They come out of the women's locker room and they are dressed to the nines. Jewelry on, they've got their hair done and their makeup done, and they come over to the treadmill and they run at about 3 miles an hour, and they're kind of doing this thing, and you know, guys are walking by and gawking at them. This is the picture of the man in the Greek gymnasium. He would preen, and he would just kind of be there on display, so much so that it was tradition in the Greek gymnasium for men to work out sans their clothing. All the men in the gym were oiled up, woohoo, you know, nothing there. Trying to be appropriate for the people that are listening to this in their car with their children. They were just there, oiled up and working out. That just does not seem good. And the worst part is, the synagogue, now do you get the picture? The Greek gymnasium was a place of heavy secularism. It was the height of Greek culture and Greek and just Greek teaching. They had public discussions on the most wretched and secular of subjects in the Greek gymnasium. It was a place where only men were allowed, for the record. And while they were there, the male form was exalted as much as possible. In the midst of this, the local synagogue literally had an open courtyard that flowed right into the gymnasium. And when walking out of the gymnasium, you walked through the Jewish synagogue. It's crazy to me that these two things were connected. I can't even begin to make the proper connection in our culture, but it would be like us having a Planned Parenthood group that was connected to our church, and the two just kind of interacted and were copacetic with each other, which I would consider to be absolutely, positively wrong. I can't even put it into words what this was like in that culture. And so we begin to get a picture, because the church met in the Jewish synagogue, and we begin to get a picture in this culture of how deeply embedded the church was in the midst of a culture that was dead and dying. The best part is, Artemis in her temple was known as the goddess that could bring people back from the dead. This is great. So Jesus has something to say to that city, to that church, and to that culture. And we catch up with it in chapter 3, verse 1. To the angel of the church in Sardis write, "He who has the seven spirits of God, the seven stars, says this, I know your deeds, that you have a name, that you are alive." You know what's going to happen, don't you? "But you are dead." You're in a city that celebrates life through a cult goddess. She celebrates as though she is alive, but you know what? I know for real what you're actually doing, and you are dead. In the shocking irony back of the last page, Jesus Christ compliments Sardis for their name, their identity, being alive, but criticizes this label with the reality that they are actually dead. This helps us to see why Jesus Christ introduces himself the way that he does in this letter. He begins with descriptions of the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. This is the picture of Jesus Christ standing in the midst of the Holy Spirit of God and standing with the seven stars, which represent the churches and its leadership. Jesus Christ is in the midst of things and he says, I see what your deeds really are. That you're acting on the outside as though you're alive, but I know for real what's going on in your hearts. They are cold and they are dead. The problems in Sardis, letter C, are not going to be solved through harder work, through better understanding. They're not going to be solved by issues of knowledge. The solution to the spiritual death which Sardis is experiencing is given by Jesus in verse 2. He says, wake up! It's how he leads the verse, like it's just abrupt and sudden. You say you're alive, but I see that you are dead. And what does Jesus Christ say? Wake up! Arise! Literally, bring yourself up back into life. Jesus Christ is telling the people that the very things that they need are not physical solutions to their problems. They are spiritual solutions. And we should be clued in by this because it's in the book of Revelation, where if there's one truth that I hope is being hammered home from this pulpit and in our growth groups, it's this. What we see and experience on the human level is not all that is going on. There are spiritual realities around us that are even more significant. There are spiritual things that are happening around us that are even more significant than what we can see, hear, and feel. And because of that, we are constantly called not to engage things in simply a physical way, but to engage things in a way that's truly going to change the future. And that is spiritually. To engage this world and these situations and these circumstances that we live in, and not just keep buying into death, but buy into real life. And where is real life found? It is found in Jesus Christ, the one that stands in the midst of the churches, the one that holds the seven stars in his hand, the one that is in the midst of the seven spirits of God, in the midst of his church, who sees our deeds and says to us, I know what you think looks like life, those actions on the outside, but I see your hearts. What is needed here is not more good doing. What is needed here is a change which will bring you from death to life. And Jesus Christ cries out, wake up! Arise! You are not to live this way. And why? He gives it in verse 2. Strengthen the things that remain which were about to die, for I have not found your deeds completed in the sight of my God. Do you see the picture of resurrection here? Jesus Christ comes to the dead church and he wakes them up. Wake up, you're not done. Can you imagine dying and then having Jesus step in and just go, hey, you weren't done. I got more for you to do. I don't know why you're dead. Come on, let's go. I have power over life and death. You know, I was the resurrected one. And I'm the one with power over life and death, not this Artemis clown. And I'm the one that can bring you back to life. And not only do you need to wake up, but you're not done yet. Your deeds are not complete. And I see them. I know that you're acting like you're alive, but you're really dead. Letter D. The church needs Jesus Christ in their midst. We need to recognize that. Because when he comes with the Spirit of God, he brings true spiritual insight, spiritual power, spiritual vitality for the dead. Do you ever feel like you're dead? Do you ever feel like Jesus is very far away? Where has God gone in my life? Why can I not sense Him, see Him, feel Him around me. Jesus Christ, make no mistake, has the power to resurrect dead people, even as you sit there, even as you look alive, but you are dead. Jesus is calling on you to wake up. Arise. Don't just sit there. There's more for you and I to do. Jesus resurrects dead people for new and greater things. Number three, letter A. This now begins a series of urgent commands. They're all in the imperative in the original language. Jesus Christ calls the church in just kind of this rapid fire fashion to remember, receive, hear, guard, and repent. Let's read it in verse 3. So remember what you have received and heard, and keep it and repent. Therefore, if you do not wake up, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what hour I come to you. If they do not respond to this urgent call, the return of Christ will come and they will miss it. Unfortunately, this is the condition, is it not? Number three, letter B. This is the condition of many that are in the church. Revelation calls us to live in an urgent response to Jesus, to break out of our lethargy, to break out of our seeming just kind of being lulled to sleep spiritually. We can still look, oh gosh, I almost fell. We can still look like we are alive. We can still look like we are alive, but in reality, how many of us are not even experiencing the spiritual life that we seem to look like? This is what Jesus says. I see you. I see your deeds. I know what you're up to. Wake up. Wake up to me. I'm the one that holds the church. I'm the one that is in the midst of the Spirit. You're not fooling anyone. When we worship, when we serve, when we live this life, we do it in front of an audience of one. Do not be concerned with the physical audience that is around you. Do not be concerned with convincing all of us that you look good. I am not to be concerned with whether or not you think I'm doing a good job. I am to be concerned with what Jesus thinks. I worship and I live for an audience of one, not the audience of 300 that are here. This is critical for each one of us to understand and embrace. If there's one thing that I believe is so true, it's that people can walk through the church and they can fool everyone. But Jesus says, wake up. You're not fooling me. I see you. I see your deeds. I loved it when my children were very, very young and they would cover their eyes and they would think, I can't see him. He can't see me. How many of us do that spiritually? Like little children, we cover our eyes and we say, out of sight, out of mind. And Jesus says, I see you. I know you. I know your deeds. Wake up. Figure it out. Arise. You were dead, and there's more for you to do. Make no mistake, and the key of this, I think, is there in letter B. In order to break out of the lethargy, we have to live according to a true view of Jesus. It's not what we do. It's not the way we look. It's not putting on better works. It's who you believe in. It's what your vision of Jesus really is. It's all about who you are following. I find as I work my way through these verses each week that what matters for me personally is that I am not the one that is in control. I am not the one that is in charge of my own ship, my own life. But then my vision of Christ is so transcendent. It is so big. It is so huge that I would never want to do or follow anybody else. I believe that what Jesus Christ is saying to the church is not you got to clean up your act. I believe what he's saying is you got to clean up who you're focused on. You're focused on yourself. You're focused on the people around you. You're focused on the physical world. Get real. Do you know who I am? And just to make that perfectly clear, he led the book off that way. Do you remember? That's why I refer to it. Verses 13 through 18 of chapter 1. I tell you, I find myself before I read any of the verses that are in the next section of Revelation. I go back to that section and I read it over again. We've had you read it in your growth group every week. Why? Because it's the most important part of this book. Is the vision of Jesus Christ established in verses 13 to 18 in chapter 1. So often, our problems are not centered in the things that we do, whether they are sinful or whether they are good. They are centered in who we follow and what we think of Him and whether or not our problems are bigger than our view of Jesus. Whether or not the future of our lives, that's more significant than what I think Jesus can do. And that's why verses 13 to 18 flip. They flip it. They flip it all upside down. The church is not what you think it is, Jesus says. I am not who you think I am, Jesus says. Your problems are not what you think they are, Jesus says. This world is not what you think it is, Jesus says. Come, check this out. And he absolutely smokes us with verses 13 to 18 of chapter 1. Imagine if you were there, because folks, you are. This is reality. When this earth burns away, you know what you're left with? Verses 13 to 18. And also starting in chapter 4. But we'll get there, all right? We'll get there. To the overcomer, and the overcomer is kind of another way of saying to the faithful. And he picks this up in verses 4 and 5. Verses 4 are the faithful that are in the church. Verses 5 are those that will overcome, that choose faithfulness instead of continuing to live the way that they were. This is the overcomer in the book of Revelation. And so he speaks to those in verse 4. You have a few people in Sardis who have not soiled their garments. That's a great way of looking at it, isn't it? Imagine if your clothing showed the inner heart. Imagine if what you wore on the outside of you looked like the inside of you. What would you look like? Now, don't get all beat up. Oh, I would look terrible. I would look like a homeless person. I would just be dirty and I would have holes in my clothes. Hey, ease up. Sometimes we get overly focused on the crud that's inside of us. Do you get that Jesus Christ offers to give you new garments? I'm actually not super concerned with how you look on the inside. What I'm concerned about is who are you focused on? Is it your kids? Is it your wife? Your husband? Is it your job? Is it some other thing that is addicting and obsessing to your soul? Jesus Christ is calling us to take our eyes off of these things and to set them on Him. To the overcomer, the faithful one, verse 5, Christ gives garments of white, hits his purity, a name of life rather than death, and a name which Christ advocates in front of God and also of angels. That's from Matthew 10. Here is what it says. To he who overcomes, verse 5, you will thus be clothed in white garments. I will not erase his name from the book of life, and I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. Now, any of you that have an ounce's worth of concern are probably concerned with that second promise in there. You're like, okay, I'm good with the white clothes. I'm good with the confession in front of God. I'm a little concerned that I can get my name erased. And I just, you know, there are I've told you this before. The Bible is not terribly concerned with the security of your salvation. It's really not. Not nearly as concerned as we are. I got to tell you, there's a lot of verses that make you go, uh-oh. And then there's a lot of verses that make you, oh, that's I'm in the palm of His hand. That makes, oh, that's a cozy feeling right there. John 10 talks about that. Not only that, there's in Revelation 20, it says that when God comes to the judgment, He opens books. There's not even one book. There seem to be multiple books. A Lamb's Book of Life. There seems to be a Book of the Living and those that are dead. There seem to be multiple books that only Jesus Christ can read and open and that kind of thing. And so it's a little confusing when they refer to the books in the Bible. And I'm not totally sure what this is referring to, except to know that if you are a follower of Jesus Christ and you are an overcomer, in other words, you are a faithful one, you don't need to worry about your eternal salvation. The bottom line is, if you live faithfully, this is not an issue. The only people that need to worry about whether or not they are going to go to heaven are those that are living unfaithfully. Now, I know that even that's troubling because you're like, well, I'm not totally faithful. I can probably find something that I sin in. Yes, so can I. However, that's really not the measure. We're getting our eyes off of Jesus, aren't we? We're getting our eyes onto ourselves and kind of going, okay, well, I need to weigh out. Do my good works, are they better than my bad works? I mean, if I lie about eating a cookie, is that better than feeding the homeless? All right, I'm in the right direction here. Okay, your righteousness is not your own. Your righteousness is rooted in Jesus Christ. When you become a Christian, you're substituted, right? It's not about you. You can't do anything that will lower your righteousness in the sight of God. And you can't do anything that's going to make God more happy with you or make God more sad with you. It's not the way it works. However, anyone who is indwelt by the Spirit of God, given to us when we have responded to the salvation that is offered in Jesus Christ, whenever we have that relationship with God, the Bible says God will transform us from the inside out. And progressively, we are brought into a deeper and deeper relationship with God. So who are we speaking? We're using an illustration here. We're using an illustration to say that if you're an overcomer, you just need to know your name's in the book. You need to know that your clothing will be white. You need to know that when the accuser, the devil, stands up to accuse you of evil, Jesus Christ will stand up and say, no, no, no. This one trusted in me. They get my righteousness. And Jesus Christ will stand up for you in front of God. And when God looks at you, does He see you in all your dirtiness? No. He sees His Son standing in your place. This is great news. This is a great reward. This is part of what the overcomer gets. He gets, or she gets, Jesus. That's the whole point of all these rewards. I don't know if you've noticed, but every time it says the same thing. You get Jesus. We start the passage with Jesus. We end the passage with Jesus. Every time. If you pick that up, this will be way easier, okay? If you pick up kind of the pattern that is going on through these churches. It's about Jesus. It's not about us. In summary to this letter, letter D, the church in Sardis has people who have slowly fallen asleep. They're like the frog in the kettle. Have you heard that before? You can put a frog in cold water inside of a kettle, and it'll stay there, right? And if you heat up the water slowly, the frog never senses the danger that it's in, and it will boil to death. But if you throw a frog into boiling water, what does it do? It jumps right out. It makes haste to get out of there. So often, that's our lives, right? We are the frog in the kettle, slowly being boiled. little insignificant things that go on in our lives. And pretty soon, we are so far off of what God has for us. This is Sardis. They were assimilating into the local culture to the extent that they had become anesthetized to the effects of sin in their midst. Jesus calls for passion, for perseverance, as an authentic overcomer, one who is living faithfully from the inside out, not focused on what we do, but on who it is that we follow. All of it centered on Jesus. It starts with Jesus. It ends with Jesus. And in case your Jesus is too small, in case your problems are too big, in case your sin is overly significant, in case you are troubled and worried about this world that we live in and you just don't know what poor Jesus is going to do, read chapter 1, verses 18, 13, all the way through 18. And it will clarify for us exactly what Jesus is up to. I'm going to invite the worship team to come up to lead us in response. And like the church in Sardis, I want to call you to this. Will you bring all of the things, all of the stuff that you realize are bigger than your Jesus, will you bring them right now to a place of confession to the Lord? Will you take time in the midst of this worship to bring your own life to Jesus? Will you replace the issues, the view that you have of Jesus, and will you let Jesus do His thing? Will you allow Jesus to do what Jesus does? He takes dead people and He brings them to life. This is what Jesus does. Takes that which is broken, busted, screwed up, and messed up, dead, and He transforms it because He is not done with you. He has more for you and I and Long Beach Lions Church to do.